In 1916, a white-haired executive stood before Washington's elite at the New Willard Hotel, demonstrating something extraordinary: voice calls connecting guests to General Pershing at the Mexican border, and a revolutionary wireless telephone that left the audience staggered. Theodore Vail, president of AT&T, had transformed a scrappy startup into America's most powerful monopoly. But here's the twist. 40 years earlier, that same company was just three people working in a Boston attic, challenging the telegraph giant, Western Union. How did Bell go from underdog to empire? And more importantly, why does this pattern keep repeating with every new technology we create? From radio to film, television to the internet, information industries follow an eerily predictable cycle. They begin open and chaotic, then consolidate into empires, only to be disrupted again. Understanding this rhythm isn't just academic, it's essential for recognizing the forces shaping our digital lives today. Alexander Bell's telephone didn't just improve communication, it's threatened to destroy the telegraph entirely. This is what economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction, where innovation strikes not at the margins of profits, but at foundations and very lives of existing firms. Western Union initially dismissed the telephone, then tried crushing Bell's tiny company, yet Bell's patent became an impenetrable shield. Western Union dismissed telephones as irrelevant, selling its stake for just 20% of Bell's rental income. Theodore Vail arrived in 1878 with Schumpeter's dream of a private kingdom and will to conquer. After Bell's 1894 patent expiration, hundreds of independents emerged. New Mexico farmers even strung wire between fence posts. This open era ended when J.P. Morgan summoned Vail to Jekyll Island to build the greatest wire monopoly the world had ever seen. Vail's slogan captured his vision: one system, one policy, universal service, meaning total elimination of competitors. Vail's masterstroke wasn't crushing rivals, it was inviting government oversight. When Taft investigated AT&T's monopoly, Vail requested regulation. By accepting government-set rates and common carrier status, Bell avoided breakup. The 1913 Kingsbury Commitment required selling Western Union and granting independents access to long-distance lines. Yet, this apparent concession actually sanctioned history's most lucrative monopoly. Vail had eradicated competition while genuinely committing to public service. His controversial legacy endures because this playbook, consolidate power, then invite light-touch regulation, keeps reappearing in modern tech. In 1912, theater owner Adolph Zukor waited 3 hours to meet Edison's Motion Picture Patents Company president, seeking permission to screen Sarah Bernhardt's Queen Elizabeth. The answer? The time is not ripe for features. This dismissal forced Zukor to become one more outlaw, a decision that would create Hollywood. Edison formed the Motion Pictures Patent Company in 1908, pooling 16 key patents and fixing industry prices. Distributor Carl Lemmel heard the terms at a 1909 meeting. Only trust members could make or import films. Theaters needed $2 weekly licenses, and rule breakers faced boycott. Despite the safer path, Lemmel declared himself an independent. As the trust sued Lemmel 289 times over 3 years, independents fled to Los Angeles, where they could quickly escape across the Mexican border. The trust banned film stars, limited movies to 10 minutes, and imposed strict censorship. When Fox and Lemmel countersued in 1912, federal courts dissolved the trust in 1915, unleashing over 4,000 films in 1914 alone. Yet, Zukor's eventual centralized studio system made speech control possible again. By eliminating independent producers, distributors, and theaters, the production code gained unprecedented leverage. Industrial structure determines the limits of free speech in America. In 1922, Herbert Hoover declared advertising on radio inconceivable. The same year, AT&T aired the first major radio ad. early radio exploded from 5 stations in 1921 to 525 by 1923, pioneered by amateur hobbyists driven by connection, not profit. Many believed radio could bring the president's voice directly into homes, not in cold, impersonal type, but in living speech. Yet AT&T leveraged its telephone monopoly to create the national broadcasting system, reaching 65% of American homes by 1924. After losing patent suits to David Sarnoff's Radio Corporation of America, AT&T sold its network to RCA, which became NBC. By the 1930s, American radio had transformed from an open medium dominated by amateurs to big business controlled by a radio trust. The Federal Radio Commission aggressively favored large commercial broadcasters. The dream of radio as democratic utopia had given way to centralized control, proving once again that open systems naturally consolidate without vigilant intervention. Daniel Lord, a Jesuit priest denouncing media filth since 1915, wrote the production code that governed Hollywood from 1934 to the 1960s. Early 1930s films were remarkably edgy, epitomized by Mae West's liberated characters. After her second film, Lord threatened a day of reckoning, which materialized when Paramount announced her third in 1934. While the First Amendment prevents government censorship, private entities face no such restriction. By the mid-1930s, Joseph Breen wielded extraordinary power. Liberty magazine claimed he had more influence in standardizing world thinking than Mussolini, Hitler, or Stalin. This worked because filmmaking rights were controlled by just a dozen men who subjected themselves to Breen's veto. The centralized structure created by the very outlaws who fought Edison's monopoly now enabled different control, exercised by private moral crusaders wielding economic leverage. In 1926, John Logie Baird and Charles Francis Jenkins demonstrated early television systems, followed by Philo Farnsworth's superior electronic version in 1928. RCA's David Sarnoff, determined to control television and protect radio's advertising model, orchestrated a strategic delay. The FCC, staffed by former Bell and radio industry employees, accepted RCA's claim that premature commercialization might lock in inferior standards, freezing development from the late 1920s until the 1940s. At the 1939 World's Fair, Sarnoff staged television's American birth, declaring, "Now we add sight to sound." The media credited RCA with the invention, forgetting earlier demonstrations. Farnsworth, despite holding crucial patents, fell into bankruptcy and depression. This deliberate suppression to protect existing business models stands as one of history's most brazen examples of industrial manipulation, a cautionary tale as similar patterns emerge in our digital age. The ancient cycle persists. Centralized power rises, falls, and rises again in our information industries. While American democracy created constitutional safeguards against concentrated political power, it has been less vigilant about private economic power influencing public life. We need a separations principle for the information economy, maintaining distance between information developers, network infrastructure owners, and access tool controllers. History proves the dangers of vertical integration. The Radio Trust's advertising model narrowed content, while film suffered under Edison's technological monopoly and later under studio-controlled exhibition that enabled the production code's private censorship. Contrary to popular belief, the information revolution wasn't caused by laissez-faire capitalism, but by judicious controls on private power. Despite our current golden age with unprecedented media diversity, we may be near the high point of a pendulum that has always swung back toward centralization. The next empire could arise from carriers taking over content, Hollywood merging with telecom, or even Google abandoning openness for survival. With everything converging onto one network, the potential for control exceeds all previous eras. We must secure our sovereignty over information choices now, before others take it from us. The cycle doesn't have to continue, but only if we recognize the pattern and act.